tuned in to Radio Aryan.
The next speaker is Dr. Jim Loothwaite. I'm going to say a few words. He is chairman of the British Democratic Party. Have I got it right, have I?
British Democrats.
Yes. Okay, so if you'd like to take the stage, Jim.
It's a sedentary posture. I'm not a great orator.
I see.
I should be reading left. I should be reading this out, so to speak. Liam has just stolen onto my thunder because the point he's made is the point I was going to make, which is, to begin with, all my adult life, like most of the people here, I've felt extreme alienation from the way history seemed to be going. The last 50 years, history seemed to be going in one direction, the wrong direction. And every year I felt more and more a stranger in my own country. I don't suppose that anybody here felt any different. So, had Liam not said that, do we celebrate, as it were, the triumph of Western liberalism? Fukuyama, not very long ago, said that Western liberal democracy was the end of history. There was no further point to go. It was the end stop. It was the ultimate perfection, and there was no progress beyond it. Well, as Liam has just mentioned, there's been a populist reaction of late. It might be called the chocolate principle, in that it's green and black. In other words, it's both the extreme left and the extreme right. But it's clear that the traditional Western liberal system is beginning to collapse from its own internal contradictions. It's reached the end of its own road. Now, we can concentrate, obviously, and I'm sure some speakers will, on our own domestic problems. We can concentrate on Brexit and our relation to Europe. But if you look outside Europe, what's the rest of the world doing? Well, it's carrying on regardless. It's paying lip service to Western liberalism insofar as it has to every now and again. But it's basically true to its own traditional values. So if you look to the big boys of the 21st century, they are not going to carry on respecting Western liberalism when they don't have to, when they are more powerful than the EU and North America and the rest combined. The early outriders of this phenomenon, people like Shinzo Abe, who's never been given any attention, as far as I can make out, in Britain, but he's a fanatical Japanese nationalist.
Yes.
He visited the Yasukuni war memorials, where Japanese war criminals are buried. In earlier times, that would have been the end of his political career. He'd have been forced to resign. In fact, his majority increases every time. So that tells you about how the Japanese feel. And of course, they're rigidly opposed to any immigration. There was a time when it was suggested that cheap Pakistani labour be brought in to sort of work on the microconductors, and it was stopped dead in its tracks. But Shinzo Abe has been never given any attention because he was an example of a countercurrent. He wasn't subscribing to Western liberalism, and it did him no harm at all. More recently, we've had a certain Mr. Putin in Russia. Well, he's not a communist. He's a Russian National Socialist, or, well, a Russian National Kleptocrat, really. I mean, he's the biggest millionaire. He's got pals, the oligarchs, who are millionaires, but he himself is fabulously wealthy. He's a socialist only insofar as the sort of socialism that says socialist with knife and fork wishes to meet like-minded comrade with meat pie. Putin has set an example of fanatical Russian nationalism. He knows how to get round Western liberalism. He knows how to play the useful idiots for what they're worth, people like Jay Corbyn, who will always stick up for him because they still fondly imagine he's got some sort of communist heritage, but of course he hasn't. Then in Turkey we have that nice Mr. Erdogan, who recently has suddenly discovered that it's terribly wrong to imprison or maltreat journalists, but previously, of course, was busy jailing them as fast as he possibly could, together with sacking teachers, army officers, and anybody else who disagreed with him. But the really big players are India and China. Now, these are societies which were the most important societies in the world before the European voyages of discovery and colonialism. They're now reasserting themselves, and undoubtedly in the 21st century, China, followed by India, will be both the two most populous nations on the face of the planet and probably the two most powerful. Are they going to carry on any longer pretending that they are against patriarchy, against in favour of gay marriages, for instance. Do you really believe these essentially traditional societies, Confucian China, if you like, and Hindu India, there's a massive drive to convert Muslims to Hinduism or kick them out or kill them. That's Hindutva, that is the reassertion of Hinduism. Remember that Hinduism means little more than the religion of India. The same root is Hindu, Indus River and India. It basically means whatever Indians do, rather like Shinto used to mean whatever Japanese do. It's not defined by a book or a creed or a theology. It's defined by simply the accumulation. Keith was speaking about 33,000 years of British history. Well, the Indians and the Chinese have simply built on each generation. They've added bits on, they've added bits of Buddhism in and bits of other things. But Hinduism and Shinto and Chinese religion, as far as it exists, are simply the accretion of centuries and centuries and centuries of built up wisdom and practices. Are they going to carry on looking to Western liberalism for inspiration when they are actually going to prove to be the stronger cultures? They can dismiss us because they can say, basically, all we had was sailing ships and gunpowder from the 16th century onwards, and they're up level pegging with us and will shortly take over. They can do everything we can do technologically. So we can basically say that Fukuyama's wrong, that what's going to happen is the reassertion of traditional societies outside Europe. What happens to Europe is essentially on a railway siding, because the main lines are going elsewhere. So Europe is going to have to adapt to India and China, not the other way around. And North America, as we all know, is under Trump and so on, it is also showing signs of bucking the trend. So how have the liberals, in inverted commas, who are really, of course, as we all know, cultural Marxists, managed to persuade so many people that they were the end stop on the railway line of history? There's two points I think need to be made. First of all, false conceptions of history. And secondly, the substitution of economism for what we've been talking about earlier, what we as nationalists respect, the idea of not a society, a weasel word, which means nothing and everything. It's an amorphous, flabby, meaningless word. What is a society? Basically a congeries of unrelated individuals. It can be anything. You can join a society, but you can't join a nation. Mm. The whole idea of what's been going on in Westernism is the subversion of the idea of the nation-state, which boils down to, if Simon Shepherd were here and not in prison, he would say Hamilton's law, which is you'll make sacrifices for your kinfolk, and we're here at the time of the anniversary of the First World War and so on. We remember the sacrifices which people made for their kinfolk, but they don't make them for strangers. Hamilton's law is basically a biological principle that you look after your genes by looking after your kinfolk. It's worth your while making sacrifices for them because your genes live on. And what's happened is, of course, all you ever hear these days on TV from left and right, from Tories and Labour, is the management of the economy and, if necessary, bringing in extra workforce, as if the people of this country were nothing more or less than a workforce which could be expanded or contracted to chase the GDP, as if that was the most important thing in the universe. Not that the economy should serve the people, but that the people are simply the slaves of the economy. Well, we would all fundamentally disagree with that and say, no, we want to reassert the concept of the nation and the folk as the entity around which the rest hangs, or from which the rest hangs. So these are the two points. One is a false conception of history and how time is going, and the second is the substitution of economy for society. Well, time. Marxists have managed to secularise and mutate a religious concept of the coming of the millennium, the entry into the kingdom of heaven. The goalpost is history is moving in a linear direction, unidirectionally towards a final goal. That could be the coming of the socialist millennium, which is always indefinitely postponed, so the cabbage queues get longer and longer. Look at Venezuela. a country which has the richest oil reserves in the world, where you can't get petrol at the pumps because A, there isn't any, and B, you haven't got any money. That is entirely due to socialist economics, which has taken one of the richest countries in Latin America and reduced it to a state in which refugees are now being turned back by the borders of Ecuador and Peru and Brazil because they're sick of the sight of starving Venezuelans turning up on their doorstep. And that has been done purely and simply by socialist economics. But hiding behind that is the whole idea that history is linear, that it is going forwards. How often have you heard, but surely you must be in favour of gay marriage? After all, it's 2018. How does the date change a bad argument into a good one?
Yeah.
Think of
key
moments in history. After all, we have to execute King Charles II in 1642 or something. You can take any momentous event in history and say, after all, it's 1588, you know, and so on. What does that mean? It only means something if you're already committed to the idea that history is going somewhere. But you don't have to believe that nonsense. You don't have to believe in progress. That's fine for backward 14-year-olds, but, you know, grown-ups, It's the promise of hope. But hope isn't science. There's no scientific background for the idea of progress. If we look at alternatives, we have a pendular concept. Left and it's not going forwards and going backwards, progressives and reactionaries, it's left and right. We're going from left to right. Are you indicating it's time's up, Perky?
No, 5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay, I'm trying to cram it all in. There's a pendular principle. That means, essentially, that we should celebrate that the left is doing so well because it means the reaction will be all that much stronger. There will be a reaction against the left by going to the right. It's not forwards and backwards, it's left and right. Then there is the cyclical principle. And again, if you look at Stephen Pepper's four root hypotheses, you can suggest that there is a cyclical recurrence, that one necessitates the next one. The four root metaphors, metaphor and metonymy and the rest of it, that these four root concepts actually... each one brings the next one on. So you can have a cyclical concept of history. And, for instance, Hindus do, the yugas, the four ages, and so on. And then you could see what's going on in Western liberalism. You know, the famous French historian Braudel spoke of the longue durée, conjoncture of maybe 50 or 100 years, and l'histoire événementielle, which is the little froth and dust on the surface of history. What Harold Wilson meant when he said a week is a long time in politics, yeah. But then he was a politician, Enoch Powell was a statesman, spot the difference.
Yeah.
But we could look at what's been going on in Western liberalism as a conjoncture. It's a specific period of time at the end of which there is a reversal of the conjoncture, and you have another conjoncture, which may very well be the opposite of the preceding one, because one generation sooner or later says we are sick to death at what our parents and grandparents have been doing. When I was a kid, I went to school, we had religious assemblies every morning, and it produced a generation of atheists. Well, the same is, I think, going to happen when a generation, not necessarily now, but maybe in 10 years' time, will simply say we are sick to death of what's been done by our parents and grandparents, has been going on for far too long, and we're rebelling against it. The young will always rebel against something. So, trying to summarise two paragraphs in one. Already covered that, just a second. Well, the whole concept of economism, as I say, I don't need to sum it up any more than it is fundamentally wrong to take the economy as everything and the society or nation or folk as serving the economy. If you take economism to its logical conclusion, we all end up working for nothing. Because the fundamental Adam Smith principle is there is somebody in the world that can make what you're making cheaper than you can. He will beat you down because he can offer his goods at a lower price. So if you take economism, if you stand back and look at it and say, where is it leading? It's leading to a race to the bottom. It's leading to a point at which the ultimate goal of humanity is to work for nothing. Because as long as there's one person in the world or one country that can do it for less, they're going to outcompete you. Now, is that a future we want to believe in, even if it were true? But that is what economics in general is pointing towards. So it's up to us to say, well, we don't want that sort of a future, thank you very much. We'd much rather have a self-sufficient economy which provides for the needs of the people. But that means the people with a capital P, a defined people, not everybody that wanted to turn up and join the bus. Finally, we're living in interesting times, and they're likely to become more interesting because there is talk, once again, of a global financial recession. How does that affect nationalists? Well, some countries will survive and some won't. Common sense suggests that the biggest countries with the largest populations could probably lose the most and still go on. So once again, one can assume that India and China are fairly bulletproof against whatever happens to them. Yes, millions of people can die, as they used to die in whenever the Yellow River flooded or the Ganges. But there'll still be an India and a China because they're just too big to possibly succumb to almost anything which the environment, in the wider sense, not just the natural environment, the political environment, can throw at them. And that's before they have aircraft carriers in large numbers all over the South China Sea. But India and China and big countries, even Brazil, even America and so on, are big enough to survive. But is a small island off the northwest coast of Europe necessarily going to survive when it is no longer homogenous and when we can no longer assume that we can look to our history and say we will get through because we always have done? Because that's not true when we're no longer what we used to be. If you looked at the Grenfell Tower situation, I don't know about you, but I felt a stranger in my own country when I saw people jabbering and screaming at judges and saying, I mean, it was not the Britain I was brought up in, when people were fundamentally questioning, oh, what is the government doing for us? Well, what should the government do for you? What about doing something for yourself? The traditional British response, the traditional London Cockney response to a disaster like that would be to stick together, to look after each other, to look after their neighbours, and not to whine and snivel and say, what is the government going to do for us? They would just not say that. This is not the same Britain, so we can't assume that the next crisis we will simply get through by the Dunkirk spirit and by sticking together, because we aren't the same people, and there are people out there who have no identification with us or our history or our country. They came here to line their pockets, and if things go wrong, they will either riot or they will go elsewhere. If they go elsewhere, fine. But the trouble is, they'll probably do a lot of rioting before they do that and loot the supermarkets. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.